and welcome to part two of our two-part bonus episodes of Appalachian Mysteria. I'm Maddie Stout, president of Jam Street Media. And with me again are Kendall Perkinson and Sarah James McLaughlin from Appalachian Mysteria. Now, in the first part of this two-part series, we talked a lot about the art of podcasting and Merritt and Karen, the WBU co-ed murders, which if you've not listened to season one, go back and listen to it. This episode, we're really going to focus in on season two, which is Big Savage, The Death of Alexander Stevens. And if you've not listened to that, there will be some spoilers. So I would say go back and listen to that and then come check out this podcast if you've not already. Also, at the end of this episode, we're going to tease what's coming up in season three for Appalachian Mysteria. Hi, guys, and welcome back.
Thanks.
Hi.
So I grew up outside of Cumberland, Maryland. I grew up in Kaiser, and I did not know about this story with Alexander. And how did you find this and make you think, okay, this is our next project to go on? Because when you have such a project that's so successful as your first season, which, by the way, I would love to, you know, hear how you felt about the success of that, you know, knowing that, you know, you had hundreds of thousands of listeners and it became curriculum at universities. So your follow-up had to be pretty good. Why don't you guys start with talking about the success of Merritt and Karen and the amount of attention it brought to you as you thought about what you're going to do for season two?
I can't speak for Sarah, but as for myself, I was pretty okay with having put Merritt and Karen out into the world and, you know, just done something that I was proud of. And I didn't feel an obligation really to make another show at all. I knew probably I'd want to do something eventually. But when I saw this case in the newspaper, in the Cumberland Times Dispatch, it was clear that it was something that was akin to what we were already doing and was almost equally as baffling, if not more so. I shared it with Sarah. And once I was able to talk to the reporter who had written the article I read and who would be covering the trial in court, and once I found out that the courtroom would be open for anyone to come to the trial, it seemed like no matter what we found out in court, it was going to be weird. And by weird, I just mean it was going to be surprising or make other things not make sense. The truth was going to make other things not make sense if we ever heard the truth. I just could not do it. And I brought it to Sarah, and I'll let her talk about what she thought about it.
I had actually heard about the case from my sister-in-law, who lives in Preston County, West Virginia, which is really not that far from where it had happened. And she was telling me what she could kind of remember, which was no names or anything. So when Kendall told me about it, I'm like, wait a second, I think I just heard about this. And I didn't realize that he was really dead set on it at the time, because we had sort of been fielding a different segment of ideas. And so when he said, hey, I think we're going to do this case, I've got a reporter lined up that we're going to talk to, I was like, oh, well, we're full throttle on this. Let's go do it.
So, you know, finding the story in the newspaper brings me back to something I wanted to talk to you about, which is the importance of local journalism. So I grew up in the area there. I remember getting the Cumberland Times News every day. You know, that is a newspaper now that barely exists as far as having actual reporters that live there and talk about local stories, as is the case most small towns right now. Talk to me about the importance of having local reporters to bring stories like this out and for people to be able to find them and learn more about them.
So I easily make enemies in the media community by ragging on how terrible the media is. Mainly, I'm talking usually about mainstream and, you know, sort of legacy media stuff. But these local reporters are the people doing real journalism. I mean, a lot of times you'll turn on, you know, you'll read your local newspaper or local news and it'll be, you know, just local team scores, stuff like that. But they're also, those local journalists are the only people doing major reporting these days. Like, national outlets can't afford to send, you know, reporters to every single strange crime scene, you know, to every single thing that happens all throughout the country. So local news reporting is extremely important.
Sarah, you know, being a journalist and you know, I want to kind of ask you the same question, and how helpful was it to have local reporters, especially in some places small as Garrett County, you know, Maryland, where there's not a lot of stuff that goes on. I can say that because I grew up near there.
I got to say, when when he told me we were meeting with a reporter, I really didn't know what to expect. I have my opinions about the newspapers around here in general, just because I get really frustrated when they don't follow up on stories. I feel like I have to do a lot of work to try and see, okay, well, that guy was, you know, arrested. Is there a case now? And if the story's not hot, they sort of drop it. And this kind of helped ground me with just how much work reporters actually put into it. And they don't really have control over whether the story actually gets told, like the conclusion is ever put into the newspaper. And I got to see Teresa in action, and she is tenacious and she is smart and just really good at what she does. And she pays attention to detail. She was sort of showing us her method where she has these little tiny notebooks that she's writing in. And I'm like, I don't even know how you do that. And then after she writes about it, she just marks a big X through it. So it was kind of crazy just to see her method, because I'd never really seen that up front. Most of the stuff that I looked at was like 50 years old. And so I get to see it while it's happening. And it was kind of amazing. And it just sort of restored my faith that like reporters are still out there. They're still doing it. It's just that it gets filtered down to us and we don't always get to see what's really going on.
I think that's one of the reasons I asked that question, because it, for me, having grown up there, it really made me think, well, good. I'm glad there are people like Teresa out there covering, you know, where I grew up. And this story is just weird, man. These two, I was just saying, these are two weird kids, and there's a lot of details that just, if you didn't have somebody being meticulously covering, they just, so much of it didn't make sense. I know you don't want to talk personally about Megan and Alexander, but you know, there were things that just made you scratch your head a lot during this process of learning about them, right?
Well, we got to start right when everything was just completely a question mark. And I think if we hadn't started when we did, we would have got a totally different story out of it. But since we got to see the process sort of unfurl, we were at the same benchmarks that Teresa was at. You know, we were having all the same questions at the same time. So to actually see the story build was just crazy. So you think you answer a couple of questions, well, now you have 20 more. And that's just the way that it went. So every time you found out a little bit more, it made you question something else. And that was the process. And I mean, I feel like it's still the process.
And Kendall, you know, when I talk about these two, I felt throughout the podcast that you had a certain kinship, though, with Alexander. You know, there were certain things that you connected that I don't think most people would, especially when we get into the quantum physics and quantum suicide, which was just crazy for someone who had never heard of any of that to hear about and to understand. And it seemed like it was something that you could actually relate to.
Yeah, so I have personal connections to the area, and I've known, you know, some people coming up around Alexander's age and a little bit older. And there's a substantial like subculture, or at least a subgroup of people who are interested in things like holographic universe, the holographic memory, you know, quantum physics, you know, the Tao of physics. You know, there's sort of woo, I guess, is what some people would phrase it. But there's a very like a sacred geometry, this whole sort of mystical subculture that sort of lies in the area, like just out of sight. And I've seen it pop up over the years in this area. It was really fascinating, but also the way that Alex's life sort of went. So, you know, having big plans and then having, you know, sort of everything drop out from under you, you know, sort of questioning, you know, I went through a lot of the questioning that he did. I tried a lot of the drugs he tried and reading over some of his theories. I, you know, see myself from a while back, you know, in those writings as well. So yeah, it was interesting to try to identify with that and still remain objective.
You're very smart guy. And hearing you explain and talk about Alex made me realize just what a smart guy he was. But then that makes you question everything else about the story. Like, well, then why would you put a dog in a carrier and take it to a cemetery and go out in the woods and take off your clothes and walk? I mean, there's so much that baffles me about him. And how much of this do you think, I know there were the toxicology report came back negative, but I mean, how much of his behavior do you two attest to maybe drug use?
You know, it's impossible to make those sorts of judgments about people. But I will say that, you know, while I was interested in expanding my mind and learning about different theories and all that sort of stuff, what I think may have made more of a difference in Alex's life was this sort of like quest that he went on seeking out answers for a life that he didn't know what to do with anymore. And I think one of the big influences on him was his therapist who took the stand. She believed in, you know, a lot of these sort of, you know, new age beliefs and therapies and astral projection, all that sort of stuff we went over in the podcast. And he eventually wanted to drop out and attend the sort of like new age university that she had gone to. And I think he was just headed in that direction. I think it's not accurate to paint it as a drug fueled, you know, weirdness. It was real for him. Like these were actual theories and they are, you know, respectably discussed in society. There was just this combination of things for him specifically that made this turn out very badly. And I'm not qualified to say what those things exactly were.
I think there's also sort of a negative connotation when it comes to using drugs that not every drug treats a person the same. If you have mental illness, you're going to be affected differently than someone who doesn't. So even if you have sort of an experience with a drug, you really can't compare your experience to someone else's. And if you've not done drugs at all, then it's even harder for you to understand. But if you're taking, say, mushrooms, you're kind of quashing your ego and you're seeing things from a different perspective. And whether or not you can handle it is a whole other topic.
Of course, I went to West Virginia, so that automatically can check the drug column for me. So for me, listening and having, you know, done most of the drugs that were talked about or that, you know, he might have tried, I didn't feel that way either. But what I did wonder about was, you know, dealing with the kind of small town mentality and the folks that, you know, I grew up around, you know, they'll automatically just say, well, that's because he was all hopped up on goofballs. And in general, that kind of leads me to the next question, which is about the kind of the small town, you know, the courthouse and how things were done there. You know, what was your sense of that and how much that might have affected what went on in the trial?
I think because of the size of the community and the specific culture of the community, Alex had a hard time finding people to connect with about these things. And I think that made it especially hard for him. As I say, there's this very small group of people that maybe have this sort of underlying openness to different worldviews. But I think the environment he found himself in, he considered stunting. And after having suffered this great loss in the form of his entire planned career, I think it just compounded.
I want to take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about what a historical podcast this was, because you actually changed something in the state of Maryland. So let's take a quick break and come back and we'll hit that. Okay, we're back. And Ken, I don't think that people, you mentioned it in the podcast, but I don't think they understand kind of what a big deal it was to get the 911 tapes released. I think a lot of people would try to get the tapes released and say, okay, they're saying no, oh, we'll have to move on. But you didn't. Talk about that.
It's fairly common for journalists to ask for 911 tapes. They're widely known to be publicly available information. Almost every state has laws specifically allowing the release of, you know, 911 tapes, at least in certain situations. When we tried to get the 911 audio, that was the first time Megan called for help in the woods when she was naked and nearly frozen. Garrett County refused to give us the audio, as we mentioned. The county attorney's theory was that this violated the wiretap laws. Wiretap laws basically prevent you from sharing audio without people's permission, sharing people's conversations, phone calls, recordings. But the law specifically carved out exceptions for, you know, emergency audio. And I was just pissed, frankly, that they were refusing to give them to us. And I couldn't see a reason why. I didn't really understand it. And then I eventually learned that this had been going on in Garrett County for decades, 30 years or so. So no reporters had ever been able to hear 911 audio, or citizens. You know, no citizen could request this information and receive it. So it was something that was worth fighting in court. It took a lot of time. There's nothing I hate more than paperwork and bureaucracy. And that it was just months and months of paperwork and bureaucracy. But I hated what happened so much that I wanted to make sure that we ended up, you know, getting the audio. And it was absolutely relevant to the show and to people reporting on the case.
And when Kendall says that it didn't make sense, it's because they were sending us the transcriptions of the audio. So for them to not give us the audio when we already have like a script in front of us, it just felt shady, like we were missing something. It didn't make any sense why you can't have the audio file, but you can have everything that was said in it.
And the 911 tapes, to me as a listener, I mean, it was vital to hear her voice, because you could try to describe that voice all day and you can never really describe what it sounded like, because it is so unique, and you really can hear a lot of emotion in the voice on the 911.
Well, this
tapes.
Actually became a conversation in court. It wasn't the interesting conversation I was interested in having with the judge, but it was the conversation the judge thought we were having. His question was, well, this is an interesting conundrum, because does the actual voice convey more information than the text itself? This was something he sort of asked out loud. I don't think there's any way to cover a case like this and think that you don't understand better after hearing this, like someone who can barely speak because they're nearly frozen. I don't know if they were concerned that, you know, that would paint a sympathetic portrait, you know, just prior to their prosecution of her, or like he says, whether this was a longstanding thing. I'm not sure, but either way, it was definitely relevant.
What did you think, Sarah, the first time you heard her voice on those tapes?
I had read the transcripts prior to listening to it. And when the operator thought that she was a young girl, it was really obvious after listening to her why you would make that mistake. It wasn't like a bad connection or anything. Like, she does have a childlike voice.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, you talk about the voice later, about during the trial, how she would sink into that voice again. And if I hadn't heard it, I would not understand that.
Well, and I know you understand there's different voice types because you do broadcasting and, you know, like vocal fry, all that. But like, there was something about her, like almost slipping into what I consider like the customer service voice, where your voice goes up an octave because like that's just how you talk to people when you're trying to be like, hey, I would like to help you. How can I help you today? And she would sort of just, she had these weird vocal patterns, and her crying, she was like choking through these things. And if you weren't there, you don't really understand. So the actually having the audio kind of highlighted what it sounds like for her as a baseline. And then when you add the crying to where like you, it's so high pitched that if you have bad hearing, you can't even really hear it. Like it's really difficult.
Do you feel like her performance on the stand really was detrimental to her? It sounded like, you know, just from the descriptions of how she would go into the voice and she rolled her eyes and things like that. You know, it didn't seem like she endeared herself much to the people in the jury or in the crowd.
She really didn't. And I just cannot understand why. It was almost like she was in denial, like she was upset that she had to be on the stand in the first place. And I think if you're fighting for your life, which if you get a life sentence, you should be fighting for your life. She wasn't respectful when she should have been. She was doing things behind the prosecutor's back. Whenever the prosecutor would turn her back, she would roll her eyes, and like everyone else could see that. The judge could see that. And I'm very sympathetic to Megan. Like I don't feel like she is really understood. I don't think it's fair to say that she's a villain here, but the way that she portrayed herself when she should have been checking all of her P's and Q's, she totally dropped the ball. And none of that was going to show up on a court transcript. Like, you just had to see it.
How was the relationship between the podcast and the families? And I want to contrast them between as you were doing it and then maybe after it came out. How has it been?
We had the opportunity, both Sarah and I individually, to approach the family about participating or answering any questions. I mentioned in the show that was a really uncomfortable thing for me to do, because I know that I'm talking, and I knew that we were going to be, you know, covering topics that may be difficult. Some things that came out just as a matter of the trial that were sort of like, you know, family dirty laundry type stuff. You don't want other people to hear about, you know, the fights you had with your family and all that mess. And it made me really uncomfortable to have to approach them, but we did because we felt it was, you know, the right thing to do. And they have as many answers as anyone else does that we'd love to ask them about, but they've been very closed off about this. They wanted to put it behind them. And Alex's father just recently died. He just recently passed away. And before that happened, they had the entire case sealed by a judge, which means that none of the evidence submitted at trial can be discoverable by reporters any longer. So there are still ways to get access to some things that didn't come up in trial, perhaps. But, you know, the Stevens family just want to put this behind them. And Megan's family, we also approached. They had no reason to trust the media either. It's hard trying to get people to trust you as a media person nowadays. It probably always was, but I feel like especially now, people feel that there's spin everywhere, that it's unavoidable, and that they have no control over the product that's going to be made. So I think that went into a lot of it. And, you know, I think they want to remember Alex as he was, you know, they want to remember, you know, the bright, loving person that he was. So the families are ready to put it behind them.
When we were approaching people in person at the trial, Megan's family was very polite. They didn't want to talk to us. And Alex's family talked to us a little bit. And they're like, well, you know, like maybe contact us and we'll talk to you later. And they didn't. And I think that's a polite way of saying, like, I don't want to deal with this right now. Because the emotions, I can't even imagine. Like, I felt the tension in that courtroom from being there. And I wasn't personally involved with it. So I can't even imagine what it's like to try and process that on top of some people coming up to you and wanting to say, hey, we would like to do an in-depth coverage of this. You know, like I totally understand why they weren't interested, but I also tried reaching out to Megan in prison and I never got anything there. We did talk to some of Megan's friends and they said that they would talk to Megan and try to get her to listen to the podcast to see that we weren't trying to demonize her. But we never heard anything back from her either. And that's probably under the advice of her lawyer.
I was in contact with one person who claims to have been a longtime friend of Megan and who has spoken to her since she's been behind bars. And she told Megan about the podcast. So even if Sarah's letters didn't reach her, she has heard about it. She said that she wouldn't be interested in making comments unless we sent a full transcript of the podcast into prison. Not only am I unsure that it could get through. There are sending things into jails and prisons is actually very, the rules are very complicated and it's unclear. Sometimes things just disappear. They're just thrown in a rejected pile. Not to mention the fact that we don't actually have transcripts made. So I don't know about, you know, trying to make a transcript of the entire show in the vain hopes, you know, not only that, but then of course she would know what everyone was saying and would be inappropriately prepared in a way that you wouldn't want to do for a you know, approaching someone journalistically. You'd want to get their side of the story without them having heard what everyone else said and how it might be framed and all that sort of stuff. So we have no further contact with Megan or either of the families.
What is the latest with her legal proceedings? Is she in appeal or what's going on with her?
She's exhausted her appeals, hasn't she?
Yeah, so she filed one appeal that was about the severity of the sentence, not about the guilt or innocence, but about the severity that was overturned. And as far as I know now, the same appeals board that would have had to overturn her case was the same appeals board that refused to sort of retry Adnan Syed from Serial. It's Maryland. It's the bar is high for that sort of thing. So we're fairly certain that this is just the way the story turns out.
Wow. I was just thinking, what facility is she in? Is she in the same facility as him there in Allegheny County?
She's in Jessup. She's in the women's prison, but it's also attached, like the same building houses, male facilities as well.
I still feel after listening to the podcast, and this is not your fault. You did a wonderful job with it. I still don't know what happened. I can't for the life of me understand why any two people would jump off of a cliff naked and then one of them would kill the other one, even if they asked them to do it. Can you help? And I know you don't like to speculate, but what do you think happened?
I really honestly think Tristan put it best when she said there's only one person that knows what happened. And she pointed at Megan. I don't want to speculate either. I feel like there's a lot we don't know about because when you have stuff that's brought into a court case, it's sort of cherry picked as to what you actually learn about. And I can't form any kind of rational opinion because all of the facts are really irrational to me.
It is the confusing nature of the case that makes it fascinating to me. Look, 90-some percent of murder cases are very, very simple. Someone has a motive or a, you know, sparking emotional, you know, reaction to something or a long burning emotional reaction to something coupled with some other trauma. You know, they're very sort of like understandable things. But this case, obviously, like you're saying, it's just not that way. And I understand the frustration that people have, like with being done with the show and being like, okay, well, I don't really know much more than I did at the beginning, as far as, you know, being able to tell what exactly happened. But I don't want to be the guy who tries to piece together things, you know, that I don't know about when I wasn't there. I just want to look at the things that exist, try to figure out what makes sense, and point it out when it does, and point it out when it doesn't. And there's just not much here. I mean, it's not hard for me to imagine, you know, two people doing crazy stuff like you're describing, but it is really weird for me to imagine someone like Megan, who is just a normal, everyday, good grade, you know, extracurricular activity, working jobs person who, you know, the judge pointed out excelled at everything, you know, she did. And, you know, there wasn't really much instances of violence in Alex's past either. Like, all of the circumstances together, I just don't think we're getting an answer out of this. And I'm not going to be the guy that's going to try to pretend like I know. I just can't do it.
All right. I can speculate because I'm just a listener.
Yeah. Let's hear it.
You know, the parts that really will, I don't think even I can't even speculate is the whole taking all the items up there and the dog. And the dog in the cemetery to me is still the one part, like, I don't get that. I'm a dog person, and it sounds like Alex was a dog person and he liked animals. Like, why he would ever do that unless he was thinking he was saving the dog from something. So maybe they were just getting it on and they rolled off and she just decided to finish him off. I don't know.
Just happened to roll off with a knife and...
Yeah, that happens. I had a dollar for every time I rolled off a cliff with a girl with a knife in my hand.
God, you sound like a Deftones fan.
I do like the Deftones.
He's real big into knife play. So I guess there are couples out there that, like, cutting is, you know, it's just... a normal ritual.
Yeah, maybe it was. I don't know. It definitely, and I gotta say that I didn't see a picture of Megan until after I'd listened to the whole podcast, because I had a picture. I like to, like, have the pictures in my head when I listen to shows. I don't like to know what people actually look like. And she and Alex both did not look at all like I thought. They looked much more just normal and white bread than what I kind of imagined in my head. So I have no idea either, to be honest with you.
Did you think, like, when you looked at them, that they made a couple? Like, was that kind of surprising to you?
No, but yes, I think she was cuter than I thought she would have been. And I think he was actually more handsome than I thought he would have been, too. So I was not picturing those two at all.
I think one of the things that was sort of tossed around at the beginning when everyone was sort of frantically trying to find the facts for this case, they were saying that they were girlfriend boyfriend, and Megan was very adamant in court that they had dated, but they were no longer dating. She was very adamant that they were not girlfriend boyfriend anymore.
And to me, that's as somebody who just doesn't buy that, I always feel like they were at least friends with benefits. And there's always somebody with feelings. That's all I'm saying. There's always somebody that's got feelings when you have a sexual relationship and you move into friendship. I think that's me. What do I know?
Hey, well, you know, it's anecdotal at this point. I have no idea how to frame their relationship other than this is not something that I've ever come across before.
Well, Kendall, you're into the quantum physics and all of that. Did that relationship make sense to you at all on any level?
They seem like very different people. I think there, you know, are people on the podcast saying they seem like very different people, and I would agree with that. I wouldn't view them as visually weird being together, but, you know, what I know of their personalities, you know, it does seem like an odd match.
Guys, thank you for doing these two sessions and interviews. And I think we learned a lot about the process. And if anything comes out of this and you're a listener, just tell them, how many hours do you think, you know, if you had to put a number on it, how many hours go into each episode when you do a podcast like this?
Oh, man, that's really hard to compare, because for Merritt and Karen, we had Jeff's like 10 years of experience on top of what we put into. And then when we have the Big Savage podcast, it's, you know, like the hours that I sat in court, that was sort of the researching on top of what we had to do to kind of pull it together as a story. But I know we were out there interviewing Teresa several times and put a lot of miles on my car, I'll tell you that.
Yes, it's not just the the making of an episode the way that podcasts are made when people, you know, sit down and have a discussion about something. It's like going to the trial, then coming back, figuring out what the most interesting parts of the trial to set up the interview with Teresa is going to be, scheduling that, then driving out there, doing the interview, driving all the way back. We drove out there for at least three interviews, at least three different people, and probably half a dozen or more interviews. So, you know, an hour, hour and a half each way. It's just impossible. Then there's the script writing and the editing. I have no idea. So much
time. And we have Jordan that was helping us and who was taking notes and driving out there as well. So it wasn't just Kendall and I and Teresa. Like, Jordan was kind of working behind the scenes and she was helping us. She was sitting next to me in court and taking the notes. And I was trying to pay attention to what feelings that I could get and facial expressions. And I was like, Jordan, write down everything that they say. So between the two of us, there's several hours invested in just like taking notes. There were no recording. Like, you couldn't even bring your phone into the courtroom. So it was all by hand.
Yeah. Big shout to Jordan. She was great. And again, and I think one of the things that makes these podcasts special is just the interaction and those aside times when you were all talking about the case together and kind of formulating. To me, I found them to be entertaining. I enjoy your sense of humor a lot, Sarah. And I think that the team comes through when you listen.
I think we really gain a lot when we just sort of have a relaxed conversation about it. We try not to make it sound like it's an interrogation. And I think that's really where you are able to get people to open up. It's just, if you have the relaxed situation, you're going to get more than if someone's really nervous when they're talking to you. So it's really important that we all know each other and we're all comfortable with each other.
Well, maybe we have an idea for some podcasts in 2021 where we just do some BS sessions and talk about some cases together. But I know you guys are working frantically to put together some new episodes for the listeners in 2021. I can't tease it too much, but it will involve crime and it will involve Appalachia. There you go.
And some Mysteria.
Plenty of Mysteria. So we do have season 3 in production. Our previous seasons, as you know, were these individual deep dives into cases. So 8 episodes each. Merritt and Karen had years of research to cover, and Big Savage had a whole trial to attend and sort of detail for everyone. And then as we started to figure out what we were going to do for season 3, we realized it's probably going to be hard to find stories like that, that just have so much stuff, or at least enough to include 8 episodes worth of, you know, 45-minute episodes. So originally we planned for season 3 to be like a lot of other true crime podcasts, in the sense that it would have multiple episodes, you know, a new story each episode or two, and just sort of skip around. But the first case we started looking at, which was a double murder on the Appalachian Trail, just branched out into this web of interconnected cases, which ended up like going down rabbit holes for multiple serial killers and false accusations, and gets into the complexities of hate crimes and charging people with hate crimes, all kinds of crazy stuff. We're looking forward to sharing that with everyone. It's so complicated that it's actually hard to sum up, but it's going to be fascinating. And our tentative title right now for the season is Outlandish.
Yeah, okay. Don't sound so clickbaity, okay?
Okay.
All right, just go to the Facebook group, go to Appalachian Mysteria for updates and pictures. And if anybody wants to reach out to either one of you, do you feel like letting them know how to talk to you?
It's MerrittAndKaren@gmail.com, and is spelled out. So MerrittAndKaren@gmail.com.
All right. And if you want more about Jam Street Media, go to jamstreetmedia.com. Check out our other shows as well. Thank you, folks, and for listening. And to you two, all I have to say is, let's go, Mountaineers.
Yeah, WVU.
Eat shit, Pitt.